Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. All right, welcome to the program. Hello, everybody. It's Friday. We're here. It's been a pretty amazing week, pretty eventful, pretty historic week, in fact. So, you know, as the world's news, as the history unfolds, we're here to bring it to you, to talk about it, to share opinions, viewpoints, perspectives with our incredible array of guests. And of course, we're all doing this right now for you, our listeners, our viewers. That's why we're here. We're here to educate you, to raise awareness, and to help you become better aware of what's going on in the world, and more importantly, why it's going on in the world. We hope that we're doing a good job, and we appreciate you guys, especially everybody that is in our TNT chat community. I see you guys piling in there at the beginning of the show. We're going to give you some great insights today. I'm looking forward to bringing on some of the best people available on this. So we're going to be joined by State Department correspondent Sam Husseini in the first hour. We're going to connect him on the fly, as it were, in Washington, D.C. to talk about a lot that's going on. The last 48 hours have been eventful, to say the least, between Israel, Iran, Palestine, the UN Security Council. All of this is happening. Plus, there's an election in the United States. All of that, and we're going to talk to Sam Husseini about that in the first hour. We'll connect him in a few minutes. Looking forward to that conversation. I've got a lot of questions for Sam. And then in the second hour, we're going to be joined by a very special guest. He's been on the program before, live from Mexico City. Dr. Zachary Foster from Palestine Nexus is going to join us. I want to get his reactions on where things are at right now. The ultimate bait and switch has happened, folks. We're all watching Gaza, and all of a sudden, the fireworks show began above the occupied territories and in Iran. And so that's where everybody's attention's been for the last week. So meanwhile, real things are happening on the ground in the place that we're not supposed to be looking, which is back over at Gaza. We'll talk to Dr. Zachary Foster about this. I want to get his perspective as well on what's shaping up to be the new Middle East and how he feels about that. And we'll also talk about some of the propaganda that we're still sifting through from October 7th. He's got some interesting perspectives on this. We'll also share the perspectives of other experts in the second hour as well. So that's going to be really an informative and pretty hard-hitting segment with Dr. Zachary Foster in the second hour. So as I mentioned, we'll connect with Sam Husseini just in a moment. And it's interesting that Elon Musk, who likes to opine and weigh in on the big events of the day using his ex-Twitter account, and in this case, yesterday was something. Last night, the supposed Israel striking Iran. It's funny, I saw some big Twitter spaces were advertising in their headlines, Israel attacks Iran. So anyway, I go over to look, I listen, I go on to Al Jazeera, go on to ABC, CNN, nothing, no evidence, nothing at all. Anyway, back onto Twitter spaces. And the biggest space on Twitter Spaces, Mario Space, they're convinced that in the first hour, it's almost as if Iranian nuclear facilities had already been hit by the Israelis, and F-14 Tomcats had been taken out at Isfahan Airport, and all these sort of stories started building up. And, you know, air-to-air refueling over Iraqi airspace, Israeli jets working with the Americans, and all these things were being spun up on Twitter and Telegram. And again, I just sat back patiently. Where's the evidence? Still waiting. Hour two goes by. Not much more evidence of anything. Hour three goes by. Still nothing. Pretty soon, everybody's starting to realize that what they've been served up is not a juicy Big Mac, but a massive nothing burger. And that's exactly what happened last night. So Elon Musk got a little bit caught up in the hype, decided to weigh in on the nothing burger. It was tweeting as if Iranian jets had been taken out at Iranian airports and in the heartland of Iran, Isfahan air base there, affixed or adjacent to a major airport there. And he said that U.S. tax dollars were used to basically destroy U.S. tax dollars F-14 fighter jets, which Iran parlayed during the Shah's reign in the 1970s. These are like nearly 50-year-old fighter jets. Anyway, Musk, in all his great wisdom of geopolitics, opines, saying our tax dollars somehow blowing up our tax dollars. That's about as much of a condemnation of the state of Israel as you'll get from Elon Musk, unfortunately, at least at this point. We're still holding out hope that he might show a little more gumption on that front. But anyway, slow progress. Anyway, we applaud Elon for at least weighing in on geopolitical affairs, which he doesn't do that much, especially when it comes to Israel, for some strange reason. Anyway, more on that later. But as everybody was like pontificating about this nothing burger, the facts started to come in, or did they? As it stands right now, we're not 100% sure what happened, but I'm going to read the sort of breakdown of two competing viewpoints, which seem to me the most prevailing at the moment. So the first one will be the sort of verdict, if you will, from one pundit on social media, and we'll read that in a moment. But it's very difficult when there's so much noise going on. If you watch the U.S. mainstream media, what you'll find invariably on the U.S. side is you'll find a lot of speculation. The headlines are pretty bold, like Israel strikes back against Iran. But then when you read the Iranian accounts and other people in the Middle East, there was no Israeli strike on Iran. What happened was apparently four quadcopters, this is one version of events, four quadcopters were shot down or triggered Iranian air defense around the city of Esfahan. So that's what we know. That's what's reported so far. There is no statement from Israel about any strike on Iran. There is no definitive statement from any U.S. official. All you have is mainstream media, anonymous officials, anonymous British officials told this outlet, anonymous U.S. officials told this outlet, but nothing absolutely substantial. So what do we have to go by? Not much. In terms of the video evidence, we have some potential air explosions here from of what could be these like little sort of hobby quadcopters or whatever. And it's difficult to say exactly what we're looking at. So this is what Syrian girl at Partisan Girl on X Twitter. So she was on the show last week, actually, on Friday. She says, what we learned from Israel's retaliation, if we can call it that, she says. A proxy attack is not a direct attack, hence this can't count as Israel's retaliation on the escalation ladder. In other words, this looks like a potential terrorist attack from inside Iran by Israeli proxies. Perhaps Israel's foreign ministry are completely silent on the attack, hence there is no confirmation this was a, quote, retaliation. Thirdly, she says, Israel was trying to save face while not escalating to what is an all-out war with Iran. Okay, that's plausible. Iran's deterrence against Israel has succeeded. Israel isn't serious about going in to win a war against Iran. They can only kill women and children in Gaza, in parentheses there. They will likely go into Rafah and continue the genocide instead. That's her fourth point. Fifth point, Iran is now in a difficult position how to respond to this mosquito non-existent attack. Or would responding be giving it air? So what she's saying is, is Iran going to dignify this apparently weak indirect attack by Israel by some kind of big retaliation? Or are they going to just kind of laugh it off, as it were? So interesting points. That's what she's saying here. Now, another guest who we've had on the show previously has a slightly different take, or at least posted a slightly different take earlier in the day, and that is the geopolitical analyst Elijah Magnier. And what he's saying here is Iran doesn't see last night's incident as an attack. Iran has many opposition groups in the north and the south. Anyone can put three small drones in the air. What is significant is that the Iranians react quickly to small drones with small cameras and shoot them down quickly. In Israel, officials are laughing at Netanyahu that this is the retaliation you promised. So tensions are rising politically in Israel as a result. So that's what he's saying. Here's an update as well. Hashtag Isfahan, Iran. Israel's cowardly retaliation, as defined by sources, says Elijah Magner. He's saying Israel fired three missiles, not three drones, similar to the ones used to assassinate Samir al-Kintar in Syria. The missiles were intercepted by Iranian defense systems. So that's a slightly different take, that these weren't small quadcopters, but were in fact missiles that were fired from Israel, made it all the way to central Iran. So we'll see. It's difficult to say. Whatever the case is, it's extremely underwhelming and not impressive and doesn't really amount to escalation. Certainly the reaction from the Iranian government and state is pretty much, you know, a non-event. And Israel's not exactly celebrating about it either. The only person crowing about this loudly is U.S. mainstream media. So that should tell you something, maybe. Maybe that should tell you something. Anyway, we'll unpack more of this in the coming segments. Let's take a break, however, right now with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.
TNT's Joseph Arthur.
There was already lines being drawn in the sand because there was people resisting every step of the way. I was one of them. I was resisting the mask and I was like questioning that openly on social media, and old friends were going like, you know, calling me an idiot and all this other stuff.
The data coming out of Israel showing that there was basically no efficacy with this vaccine with the Delta variant. And so we knew what was coming. And at that point, we thought that the health agencies were actually going to try to be honest with the public and say, okay, the vaccines actually didn't work. We've got this new variant, you know, and try to maneuver out of it, which would then open up the door a little bit for the mainstream to go, oh, there's people being harmed. We've got some problems here. Okay, let's start talking about this. But instead, what they did is they doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down on their narrative, as you saw, and they fueled this all-out war against the people like yourself who were awake. They saw the BS coming from a mile away, and they were just asking questions.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on Today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification. 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are opportunity zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Unbiased information.
Honest and forthright.
News without the misinformation.
It doesn't matter what side you're from. What matters is what you say, the truthfulness behind it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. You're live and direct for the next 2 hours. I want to welcome onto the call right now Sam Husseini. He is an independent journalist. He's also a correspondent at the State Department in Washington, D.C., and he's joining us on the live link right now. We've got Sam via cell phone today. Sam, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Patrick. Thank you.
It's great to have you as well. Sam, there's a lot that's happened in the last 48 hours. I'm not sure where to start. Firstly, I mean, let's start with the big story. What is the feeling? What's the reaction in Washington on this? I don't know what to call it, an Israeli retaliation against Iran or not. It's hard to figure out exactly what happened through all the media noise. We're still sifting through. We can't see much of a retaliation there. What are the sort of shockwaves on this, if any, in Washington?
Well, I think in the sensibility in establishment Washington is probably, I think, a degree of satisfaction. The big question to me is why exactly did it go down the way that it did? That is, there were lots of reports that Netanyahu was going to hit Iran, was going to restrain himself somewhat vis-a-vis Iran and get U.S. acquiescence, formal, some kind of formal acquiescence in terms of going harder on Gaza, including into Rafah. So that would be kind of a remarkable development that you would be able to proceed. I mean, this whole thing with Iran could end up having very ironic effects, right? I mean, Netanyahu initiated this by bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus. So what has followed from that? Iran attacks Israel, makes it look like the victim. They just got the genocide supplemental, as many people call it, through the U.S. House. Tons of cash for Israel, as well as Ukraine, as well as Taiwan, sort of going at their pivots against all three civilizational centers, in effect, Islam, Orthodoxy with Russia and China. And now he may well have a green light. And they also eclipsed the U.S. veto at the U.N. So I realize that, as you say, Patrick, there's a lot that's going on, and I don't mean to conflate everything. But I am saying that I think that people are shortchanging in a lot of analysis as to how Machiavellian the U.S. strategy is. Their job is to undermine international law in order to continue using military force with Israel as they wish for their ends, to keep the money flowing for that, and to pretend that they are not in brazen violation of international law in the process. And they fundamentally succeeded at that. They are certainly pushing things, but the fact that they got the money through Congress and the fact that Israel, can pretend to have restrained itself in spite of all of the atrocities that it's committing on a regular basis is a substantial accomplishment by their Machiavellian standards, in my view.
So that's something that I don't think people realize. Israel has pulled off potentially a great transaction for themselves here. So all these things, so you line all this up, U.S. voting against Palestinian statehood in the U.N. Security Council, U.S. sending, tens of billions of dollars to Israel, additional above and beyond what their normal sort of stipend that they get from Washington, and also maybe a green light for Israel to announce the development of settlements in and around the Gaza area, which Netanyahu seemed to be pointing towards there. So all those things lined up in exchange for what? That they'll show restraint. I can totally see Israel basically pulling the marionette strings of Washington, using this opportunity to its advantage to get things that it wants on the ground. That's kind of what it looks like from here. This is a huge win, I think, in a way for Israel. I mean, in the bigger picture, Sam, they're losing, they're hemorrhaging support globally, but at least they still have some leverage with Washington. Is that what it looks like?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that they have a very wide legitimacy crisis, but that hasn't manifested itself as it should. And they have enormous benefits. And sometimes, I mean, there are a lot of good analysts out there who are critical of Israel, who will point to, that Israel and the United States, it's estimated, spent over $1 billion. To respond to an attack from Iran that only cost like $2 million, or that's the estimates that I've seen. Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm reminded of the Julian Assange quote, the point is not a successful war, the point is a continuous war, that the funding can continue from the U.S. taxpayer into the military-industrial complex so that the war can continue. So, and as we said, they just got more money through the House of Representatives, or at least it's on the path to getting additional funding. So, by their very, selfish parameters, this does seem like a win in many ways. The other side of it, as I referenced, the lack of legitimacy hasn't yet manifested itself. You've had successive U.S. vetoes of Security Council and now Palestinian statehood at the Security Council. You've had orders from the International Court of Justice that have not manifested themselves. Nothing has forced them to stop. There have been a lot of great statements by a lot of countries at the UN and elsewhere. I think the next step, and I've raised this before on the show, is to force things to go to the General Assembly through Uniting for Peace. The Palestinians and others have allowed themselves to be confined to the Security Council, where the U.S. has a veto. And that doesn't seem like a strategy to me. And I think that there is probably a great deal of U.S. pressure to bear on countries to not take things to the General Assembly using Uniting for Peace. Ultimately, I think that a lot of people who, rhetorically are critical of the U.S. and Israel have to sit up and do that. I'm thinking of Brazil and Turkey and Algeria, and as well as Russia and China. They've been very critical of the U.S., but they keep running into the U.S. veto with the Security Council. Well, there's a way around that, or at least a way that you can attempt to go around it using the Uniting for Peace process, getting 2/3 in the General Assembly, and really trying to force things and to force this legitimacy crisis to continue.
There's another quid pro quo item, Sam, that at least some of the Israeli reports over the last couple of days have indicated that the invasion of Rafah, the imminent invasion of Rafah that Israel's been threatening to do, this is where all the Palestinian refugees have been basically forced into this very small geographical area near the Rafah border crossing in the south of Gaza. And the Israeli press are insinuating that Washington's given the green light to Netanyahu to go ahead with that operation in exchange for showing restraint in retaliating against Iran. Do you get any indication that that one's on the table there?
Well, I mean, that's been raised by a number of people, including at the State Department briefing yesterday. At least that's how Israel is attempting to spin it and how the U.S. is attempting to spin it. I mean, I think that Biden and Blinken and Israel are very closely connected in terms of their worldview, in terms of their interests. It's hard, sometimes hard to know where one begins and one ends. So I think in some respects, Biden was itching at a way to try to give Israel a green light without appearing to be completely complicit in the genocide that Israel is perpetrating, and him, allegedly making Israel restrain itself in its strike on Iran, it may provide a fig leaf for him to say, "Oh, I prevented a wider war. Aren't I so great? So I got to give Netanyahu Rafah," which is completely insidious and diabolical and murderous. But I think that that's the way they're going to attempt to spin all of this.
Yeah. I mean, Israel has created a tremendous amount of leverage, believe it or not. That's an incredible thing, Sam. In the position that they're in, with what they're being charged with, what they've gotten away with in the last 6 months, they still have managed to create all these levers on Washington. It's just incredible. I think it really speaks to the relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and it's not a harmonious symbiotic relationship anymore. It's very manipulative, and again, Israel looks like it's in so many different ways trying to hold Washington hostage. But how long was this going to last? Because do you think that what happened on April 14th when Iran struck the Israeli positions in this massive drone and missile salvo, many of them were intercepted, but not all of them were. Is that a game changer, do you think, in the long term, Sam?
I'm not sure. I think that some of my friends are overstating that, because it shows that Iran can potentially do genuine damage to Israel. But, I mean, that escalatory cycle ultimately bumps up against Israel's nuclear weapons, right? I mean, Iran can't go to the mat in terms of just realistically with Israel, because Israel can flatten Iran. And it could, you know, could dust Moscow. Israel has that nuclear capacity and Iran doesn't. Iran can do a tremendous amount of damage to Israel, one could imagine a scenario where a lot of Israelis feel uncomfortable and start deciding that life would be better in Brooklyn and London rather than Israel. It's a very limited game change, because the escalatory cycle ultimately, Israel ultimately has a trump card. The relationship between Israel and Washington, I think, is more complex and insidious than we sometimes give it credit for. I mean, it depends by what you mean by the U.S. If we look at the U.S. public is getting shafted here. The taxpayer is getting shafted here, yes. But the establishment Washington, with its military-industrial complex, is so tied to Israel in terms of big tech, in terms of surveillance, in terms of this war in Gaza being an AI war, and you get to try out new weaponry and continue the wider colonial project. There's so much invested there. And the personalities involved of Biden and Blinken, who have been, diehard Zionists for decades upon decades. They helped ensure that the Iraq invasion happened. They kneecapped Scott Ritter when he stood in the way of the of that agenda, and so on. I think that there still is it's tough to say it's a symbiotic relationship, because it's not helping the American public. But between this narrow class of establishment Washington and Israel, I still think that they are wedded at the hip.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, how this is going to shape up in terms of, well, we'll wait and see what Israel's going to do. If they're going to seriously retaliate against Iran, what would that mean in terms of Iranian counterstrike? Or are we going to see a slight freeze here in the escalation ladder between these two countries? It's going to be very interesting, very revealing in the coming weeks and the coming months to see. We hope that things don't escalate, of course, but there's always a chance that they might. Now, the other thing, Sam, is what is your sort of sense right now going into the summer with the Trump is right now mired in lawfare. We got all these trials going on lined up in New York. So that's he's going to be tied up at least for the next couple of weeks or months there as well. But in terms of the Biden administration, Biden's reelection campaign, how they're positioning themselves right now, and how is this farrago in the Middle East going to affect the Biden administration? Do you see any main differences between the Trump camp and the Biden camp on foreign policy? And is there any chance for contrast between these two candidates, or are we looking at much the same when it comes to both?
Yeah, I think it's different flavors of the same noxious toxin. Biden will attempt to portray himself as being a steady hand who prevented a wider war, if indeed we don't see any further escalation between Israel and Iran. That to me is faulty. I think what we have seen is the militarists in Israel getting what they want, and some folks in Iran being able to say we're standing tall, but that leaves the Palestinians in a complete lurch. It, in real terms, has not helped the Palestinians. So Biden will attempt to say, look at me, I calmed down the situation. Imagine if Trump were president, he would have gone bonkers on Iran and we would have had World War III. And Trump will attempt to say, you know, if I had been there, then, you know, none of this would have happened. And I would have waved my magic fingers and so on. So, I mean, they are both, different flavors of massively backing Israel and its genocide. And they work effectively in tandem, in spite of the fact that they, you know, appear antagonistic to each other before the American public. But that's what keeps the U.S. establishment going. And I think you effectively have a majority among the American public against this. I mean, you just saw the protests at Columbia University, protests elsewhere. I think that, you know, you have people on the right who are saying, you know, what the hell, as well. But the all of those forces are kept at bay as both branches of the establishment fundamentally agree on the direction of U.S. policy.
Yeah, you had a little bit of a dust up as well, didn't you, in the State Department briefing? I'm not sure the name of the chap who you were locking horns with this week, Sam, but I think I think you were challenging him on, you know, does the U.S. recognize the Geneva Convention, I believe, or just some basic international law standards. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've asked this repeatedly in November and then again recently, and they've either been evasive or deceptive or parsing their words in a way that makes it totally hollow. And I asked, I got two questions in this week. Matt Lee of the AP eventually followed up on it to try to force an answer from them. And, you know, what's really going on is that the U.S. government is parsing out the Geneva Conventions so that they fundamentally do not apply to Gaza or the Palestinians in general. So they are denying the Palestinians a one-state solution, they're denying the Palestinians a two-state solution, and they're denying the Palestinians even the protection that is normally afforded to people under the Geneva Conventions for people living under occupation. And this is fundamentally their attempt to create this legal edifice that allows Israel, or they pretend allows Israel, to fundamentally make Gaza and potentially the West Bank now more and more into a free fire zone so that Israel can kill people at whim and have no legal recourse set up against it. And that ultimately is done because of Washington. That's not something that they can pretend to blame Netanyahu about. They are formulating this legal construction.
And this is one of the problems with this obsession with labeling armed resistance or armed liberation struggles as terrorist organizations. Mm-hmm. And that's from that sort of intellectual dishonesty and political Machiavellianism springs more bad policy on top of that. So I think you got bad after bad after bad. It really kind of starts with that idea that if you can label some people or anybody terrorists, then it pretty much gives you carte blanche to do whatever you want to eliminate them, including an unlimited amount of collateral damage, which it seems, Sam, that the American people have been, I guess, groomed into accepting unthinkable levels of violence against civilians. I mean, that seems to me one of the big takeaways of the last 6 months. I mean, a lot of people are noticing this in the attitudes, the blasé attitudes, especially of U.S. Politicians defending Israel's actions on this. What do you think on that front?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was all coordinated with a massive propaganda effort, and the whole terrorism mantra was certainly part of it. Ignoring the fact that Hamas largely targeted military facilities on October 7th was part of it. The entire edifice of propaganda about beheaded babies and, you know, mass rape atrocities and so on. That was all part of the genocidal intent. All of that propaganda was put out there in order to facilitate Israel's carnage and slaughter of civilians in Gaza. And you've had some pushback as a result of that, some domestically from the United States and some from South Africa and other countries at the International Court of Justice. But fundamentally, nothing has dislodged it. And you continue to have the reign in Washington of this, you know, establishment from the so-called left and the so-called right, they are continuing to fund this. So the quote-unquote lawmakers in Washington continue to back the perpetual wars. And the whole, you know, it's tied to Ukraine in terms of the propaganda around, provoked. Israel didn't provoke Iran when it bombed the consulate. It's even claimed the same way that the claim is that Russia wasn't provoked vis-a-vis the Ukraine. There's a whole series of fabrications around that in order to perpetuate this. And again, I go back to my point about having an authentic left and right that are coming at this, you know, anti-establishment, somehow formulating an anti-establishment center as being critical to meaningfully stopping and challenging this dynamic.
And that's the option that you're offering up on this is votepact.org. If you go to Sam Husseini's social media pages as well, you'll see links to that as well. So that's something that you're floating out, Sam, as a potential option to that sort of logjam that we are just encountering at every turn, especially on this issue of funding wars overseas in these different theaters.
Exactly. Instead of people, you know, self-loathingly voting for Biden or Trump, they can pair up and both vote for third-party candidates. There arose a third-party candidate that could draw support from both the left and the right, sort of a combination of, you know, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich or something like that, that would be a conceivable path to literal electoral victory, a peaceful electoral revolution. And I think it's more than just, you know, issue of war. It's civil liberties, it's Wall Street bailouts, it's gutting Main Street, it's corporate trade deals, the Federal Reserve policy, a whole litany, I think part of what happens with this left-right dynamic is that the establishment rams stuff through and then the left and the right bicker about it. Take immigration, for example. The desperate immigration in the United States is largely caused by U.S. interventions, corporate trade deals, and drug laws. But the left and the right could fundamentally agree on those things, so they could actually agree on the root causes. So then they wouldn't need to bicker about, oh, gosh, we got all these immigrants. What do we do with them? You wouldn't have desperate illegal immigration if the establishment wasn't able to ram through their horrid policies on those deeper structural issues.
Yeah, the irony of the immigration issue is although that's a real emotive issue on this conservative right, they absolutely want it to be there and up in flames right up to the election day because it's a huge rallying cry. And the left also have some issues like this. Certainly abortion's one of those wedge issues. They want to keep stoked as hot as possible right up to the moment of voting in November. And then after that, Sam, after the election, it's like, oh, the can gets kicked down the road again, and it gets sort of filed to the back of the cabinet. So we see this time and time again. But that's certainly something to consider. That third party candidate for me would have been Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had his position on Israel and Gaza not been so horrific. I probably would be putting him forward for a big vote pack effort, Sam. But unfortunately, I just can't bring myself to do it. But it's unfortunate.
Yeah, no, it's tragic what he did to his campaign. I mean, that certainly is a huge part of it, that he was just so hyper pro-Israel. I mean, just even more than anybody else on the stage right now. His campaign is now being run by his daughter-in-law, who's a former CIA agent. There's a whole litany of issues and question marks around Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at this point. I mean, I did a ton of work on lab origins. Mm. He cites me in his book. He hasn't made that a real campaign issue. I mean, he hasn't gone around to the labs that are doing this dangerous lab work in the United States to raise a public ruckus about that. His campaign in a lot of ways is filled with all kinds of bizarre aspects that don't lend to trusting it in any way, in my view.
It's baffling, and it's a shame because he still will get a lot of votes. He may end up being, even after this huge disappointment, as you described here midstream, he might end up being one of the most successful third party candidates in terms of total votes in November. That might still happen. The question is, what's it going to mean in terms of policy differences? Is that leverage going to mean anything in the end? That's the big question. But Sam Husseini, I really appreciate you joining us on TNT Radio this week. Much appreciated again.
Sure thing, Patrick.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Be sure to visit Sam Husseini's Substack column and also follow him on X, Twitter. He's doing amazing work. Sam has got his finger on the pulse of some of the biggest stories week in, week out. That's why we try to stay in touch with him. Look, we're going to take a break right now with the network, and when we come back, we're going to wrap up some of the huge headlines before the top of the hour. So stay with us. We'll be back in a few.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats. Spark sheer
athleticism. It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom. And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
I'm Sandra, this is Jorge, and we were adopted in 2019. I remember when they first came to us, Michael was already a teenager. The whole cliche of, they're so lucky to have you guys, and it's the other way around. They have changed our family for the better. They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. As usual, great conversation with Sam Husseini, one of the best political analysts there in Washington, D.C., especially strong on the issue of the Middle East. He's got great pedigree in that area. If you Google some of the work of Sam Husseini over the years, he's been making a big impact during his whole career. And again, we appreciate his time and his ability to join us on this program, shed some light on some of these issues. What we're concerned about when we try to get into the frame for our audience here is how are these issues, all these things we talk about, we expose everything, we explain to you what's going on, how are all these big theaters internationally, how are they going to actually shape and affect the election that's coming up this year. Is it going to help or hinder the incumbent or the challenger? But also, is there any chance that you're going to see any actual policy change in Washington, especially on this Israel issue? Of course, the Ukraine issue, we already see the shift happening there. And I think that's down to a lot of the great work by a lot of great independent journalists and independent media people. And so, look, as Sam Husseini was saying, a lot of this, he was talking about all these lies that were used in order to kind of, you know, coerce the public and governments into backing pretty much a dead end policy. So we talked about October 7th, the beheaded babies. We've debunked this and we'll continue to debunk all these things, the mass rape by Hamas. These are all like fabricated lies, literally spun up out of thin air. And I know some people are probably listening to me right now, especially if you're pro-Israel or you're a Zionist or you can't believe that such egregious lies could be manifested literally out of thin air, made into mainstream headlines. All the anchors are repeating it. The president himself lied. Joe Biden, this senile, I don't know what to, the best way to describe, I'm being kind, okay? But this guy, president of the United States, goes and says on camera, I'd show you the clip if we had it at hand, but I think many of you have already seen it. He said, I've seen photos of the beheadings, the babies. He actually said that. So he's literally making stuff up. I mean, incredible stuff he's making up. And it's not harmless, because when he says that, that's basically a green light to Netanyahu, to the IDF. It validates a lie, and it justifies in the minds of the Israelis pretty much license to go and slaughter women and children in Gaza. And they've been doing that for 6 months on the back of a whole series of lies that were carefully constructed, disseminated, promoted, embellished. And a lot of people just accept it as fact or truth, when in fact it was yarn and it was spun out of whole cloth. So Ukraine has also got a few of these. And they'll use some of these stories to trigger, you know, even international courts of justice, genocide charges against Russia, patently ridiculous. One of them is that Russia abducted hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian children. There's an ICC arrest warrant, and that's the basis for the charge against President Vladimir Putin and another Russian official, okay? So it's funny, and the other, so the Bucha massacre, that's another one. That's kind of right there in league with the fake chemical weapons attacks in Syria, which they attributed to Duma and Khan Shehun in 2017 and 18. It's kind of in that sort of category, but huge, huge mythological sort of stories. One of them is about this mass abduction of Ukrainian children. And once in a while, new evidence surfaces that basically shatter some of these incredible lies that are spun up in Europe about Russia. Here's this one. Ukrainian children who were supposedly kidnapped by Moscow turned up in Germany. Whoa, go figure. This is, wow, what an incredible story, right? Well, not really. It makes perfect sense. The revelations here debunk Kiev's myths, says Russian officials who are accused of mass abductions here, over 160 Ukrainian children who the ICC in The Hague allegedly accuse the Russians of kidnapping have been discovered living in Germany. Interesting, isn't it? Say the country's federal criminal police, the BKA in Deutschland. Okay, the head of the Ukrainian National Police, actually, no, this is the Ukrainian National Police, pardon me, Ivan of Vygotsky said Wednesday, hailed the discovery, telling national media that he had discussed the issue with Holger Munch, president of the BKA, during a meeting early in the week. Allegations by Kiev that Moscow kidnapped Ukrainian children en masse, hundreds of thousands of abducted children, that's the claim anyway, have been exposed as a lie once again after some of the purported victims have been found in the EU. Amazing, isn't it? According to Russia's Children's Rights Commissioner Maria Lvova Belova. She's among the officials to have been accused of abducting youngsters from Ukraine amid the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. So when asked about clarification, RT Deutschland, this is RT's bureau in Berlin, the BKA said its officers had identified the children after they were flagged as kidnapping victims by Kiev. Okay, so it's German police here filing this report. The personal details were checked against German records, and it turns out, yes, they're Ukrainian. Isn't that amazing? The majority of the youngsters had entered as refugees, accompanied by their parents. And this is where it gets a bit murky, but it starts to make sense. Their parents and, quote, legal guardians. So now we have a potential case of human trafficking. So let's just rewind the narrative here. So the accusation by the Karim Khan and the British agents in the ICC and the Americans, who aren't a member of the ICC but are totally cheering it on this effort, is that Russia is abducting Ukrainian children. And so, again, this is part of our exercise. When you see the propaganda, do not dismiss the possibility that it could be the opposite of what the propaganda is. So the accusation from the West, Putin abducting Ukrainian children, the reality is the West trafficking Ukrainian children to Europe. You see, the opposite. And I've seen this happen so many times. In Syria, I've seen it in Ukraine. We see it with Israel and their crimes in Gaza. Every accusation is a confession. Let me repeat that. Every accusation is a confession. This is what we've seen with October 7th and all the crazy Israeli stories. And of course, this is what we see with all of the crazy allegations against Russia by Ukrainians and Ukrainian supporters. We're talking about the Zelensky regime mainly in Kiev and their state supporters, their sponsors in Washington, London, Berlin, Brussels, and so forth and so on. So isn't that so interesting that it does turn out this way? Accompanied by legal guardians into Germany. Interesting, isn't it? So there should be a massive investigation about this, but I have a feeling this might just be swept under the rug because this undermines the whole ICC case against Russia. Interesting, isn't it? In a handful of cases, suspicion of unlawful transfer is still being looked into by the authorities. Unlawful transfer, could that be, again, human trafficking? Possibly. And so here we go. And this is how the scam has been spun up time and time again. And we always say, wait, and you'll see eventually the evidence will start to drip out and the real story will start to become apparent. And I think that's what's happening here. So this is kind of a global disinformation campaign, which has become kind of standard, really, in the West. I mean, look at how much propaganda Israel, how many stories they fabricated to blame Hamas or blame the Palestinians for whatever, just completely fabricated stories. We're talking about dozens, high profile, picked up by media, the same in Ukraine. So it's like they can't find any war crimes or anything seriously bad to attach to the Russians, other than they invaded Ukraine in February 2022. So they got to sort of make all these sort of great emotive human interest tragedy stories or horrific war crime stories. The Bucha massacre is one such story. And at some point, we're probably going to get someone onto the show to talk about that one, because actually when you drill into that story, you can see there's very little holding it together. We knew this from the beginning. We talked about it, including on this program, way back when in 2022, and the evidence continues to seep out. And it's hugely damning and embarrassing, especially for the people that are absolutely standing, by this story. It is absolutely incredible that we're still litigating this. Let's take a break here. Top of the hour news headlines coming up. TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.